Hi, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. Thanks for joining me today. I'm here in the Progressive Radio Network studio, and I want to give a shout out to everyone here at the network who does such a fine job putting up such great programming, including this show, It's All About Food, which is almost 10 years old. Can you believe that? I love talking about food. It's my favorite subject. And I really love to see the progress that's happening when it comes to my favorite food, plant food. Cruelty-free, wonderful, delicious, vegan food. All right. Can we say something? Can I say something? I want to say the end of animal farming. How many times around New Year's have I said that that's my wish for the next year? And here we are. It's close to New Year's, 2019. And I'm looking at a book with the title, The End of Animal Farming. It's got to start somewhere, and it's going to start with the title of a book. And I hope that sooner rather than later, we see the end of animal farming really happen. It's the best thing for the planet, for animals, for us, for everybody. And I'm here in the studio with J.C. Reese. He's the author of The End of Animal Farming. I can't say it enough. The End of Animal Farming. JC is the research director and co-founder of Sentience. I got to learn how to say that. Sentience Institute, a nonprofit think tank researching the most effective strategies for expanding humanity's moral circle. He previously served as board chair and as a researcher of Animal Charity Evaluators. His writing has appeared in Vox, Salon, and Quartz, and he has presented his research to academic and nonprofit audiences in over 20 countries, and he lives in Brooklyn, New York. Hi, JC. How you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me. Actually, you might know that The Economist said 2019 is the year of the vegan. So this is the year for it to happen.
Woo! The year of the vegan! Okay. I've been vegan for 30 years. So I'm ready to have a year.
Exactly.
That's awesome. The year of the vegan. Whoa. Now, we're not just a passing trend, are we? We're here to stay, right?
Exactly. I mean, that's what a lot of the book discusses, is that I'm not making arguments based on, hey, this celebrity just went vegan. That means that now the world is going to turn vegan. And instead, it's much more of a long-term movement, a long-term trend. You know, with the expanding moral circle of humanity, the same way we've had human rights movements, now we're moving on to animal rights. Technology, you know, these decades-long pushes in society are what's making me so optimistic, rather than anything that's happening today, happening this month, or even happening in 2019.
When I'm in my social circles, and everyone knows I'm vegan in my social circles because I'm very loud about it, I like to say we're taking over.
Exactly. Yeah.
We're taking over. Next year, 2019, is the year of the vegan. Fantastic. Can you tell me how to pronounce sentience?
Sentience.
Sentience.
It's That's not, how I would do
it's
it.
It's not
Sentience.
The soft T, it's the hard T.
I think it's fine either way. I've seen no definitive argument. It's tricky. I mean, it's a good word for people to have, but mm-hmm. It's not a common part of our lexicon. People sometimes think of it as just a synonym for consciousness or awareness in some sense, but it really does point to exactly kind of the feature of beings that we care about. So when we say, where do we want humanity's moral circle to expand to in the long run, it is all sentient beings. So the word makes sense, and that's why we chose it for a name.
I think it must have a Latin derivative because I speak French and sentir means to feel or to eat or to taste. And so I think of sentience from the word sentir. And it's important to think about feeling because to me that's what it's all about. The beings that can feel specifically pain and emotions. The things that we so easily dismissed for a long time.
Yeah, so humans. I'm not sure of the etymology, but if you think of sentimental, that's all having mm-hmm. to do with feelings, and that's what sentience is the capacity to feel pain, to feel happiness. Because when we think about what makes us care about a specific animal, you know, what's the feature of their mental life that's going to make us care about them, it's not, I mean, the famous, you know, Jeremy Bentham quote, you know, it's not can they reason, it's not can they talk, it's not anything superficial in that sense. It's at the deep sense, are they capable of feeling emotions, positive and negative?
I say yes. Maybe next year is the year of the vegan, and the year after 2020 might be the year of the non-human animal.
Exactly.
The sentient non-human animal.
Yeah.
Okay, let's do that. But for right now, we have a great book, The End of Animal Farming, and we're going to jump into that. Why did you write it?
Oh, well, my perspective is that of effective altruism. So I've been motivated for a long time to find the world's most pressing problems and try to do as much good as I can. I wasn't particularly committed to a certain issue. I didn't, you know, have a dog who made me really feel compassionate to animals. And I knew, you know, at a young age that I was going to spend my life working on animal rights. I had family members who were suffering from, you know, cancer and other diseases, and I felt a pull towards those. But it was really the abstract sense of doing good. I wasn't so concerned with exactly how I did it. I just wanted to have the biggest impact I could. So that led me first to focusing on more human poverty issues and global health. So malaria, for example, or just poverty in places like Africa. A dollar of a donation, you know, we're in giving season right now in December, can do so much to help a human in a distant place. We don't usually think about that here in New York City. But if we think about beyond the human species, that was really my reasoning that led me to think, oh, wow, if I consider animals as sentient beings, if I think they have some degree of moral worth, you know, you don't have to think that they're the same as a human. You don't have to think that it's a one-to-one relationship. By the very rough kind of back-of-the-envelope estimate I tried to do at one point, it was like 1 to 10,000. You know, if you care about your dog, 1/10,000th the amount you do, there's a really, really good case for focusing on helping animals. And then, of course, over 99% of domestic animals live in the food system. And over 99% of them globally, or sorry, in the United States, live on factory farms. That number is over 90% globally, and it seems like a very compelling moral issue that today we're able to actually make progress on. So this is a big part of the whole motivation for the book, is that we've scared people. It's similar with climate change. You know, we've had all the doomsday arguments talking about how bad it is. Many people are aware, or at least have seen it. And maybe they haven't internalized it to an extent, but we need to think about solutions. So not just is this a really big problem, but can we make progress towards it, and how exactly can we do that?
I like you saying that animals are not the same. And that's really an important concept that we've kind of had blinders on for a long time. Not only are they not the same, but they have many traits and wonderful skills that we don't have, that we can admire them for and learn from them.
Exactly. In fact, some people have made the argument that when an animal is on a factory farm or in some other confinement or high suffering environment, it might be even worse for them because they don't have the human ability to sometimes we'll adjust our emotions. You know, we'll come to accept the fact that we're in a place like that. Whereas for them, they might be living in a sort of eternal present, where every day it's a new one. And rather than accepting their fate and kind of going along with it. I mean, this gets really speculative, but it's not at all clear that, you know, just because they're animals, it means it's going to be less of an issue. It clearly is an urgent moral problem.
Yeah, that's an interesting point and makes me think of people with dementia as an example, where they wake up every day and it's new. Some things that they don't remember are new, and those that live in the moment like that, every day they wake up and it's the fresh horror.
Yeah.
Fresh, I mean, disaster.
There is a positive angle on it too. So if you think of, you know, your dog at home, every time they're playing with you, you're scratching their belly, they're eating food. Maybe that's also an eternal present, and it could be a sort of happiness that we're just not familiar with. I mean, I certainly feel that when I interact with my dog at home.
Yeah, that's a nice image to think about. We can learn a lot from dogs, especially about unconditional love. Okay, so the book starts out with some history about animal farming or farmed animal agriculture. What's the best term for that?
Animal farming is what I went with for the title of the book. Animal agriculture is kind of a more technical term and doesn't sound, it's more syllables, just to put it simply. But you could call it any host of things. A lot of people call the book The End of Factory Farming. Mm-hmm. Like they make a mistake and they just call it that, which is almost a good thing in the sense that we're aware that basically when you're using animals for food, it is a factory environment with industrialization. You know, basically in the 20th century and onwards, it was factory farming in that sense. But I used animal farming in the title. Mm-hmm. I considered saying The End of Slaughterhouses or The Last Slaughterhouse or something like that, because people really point to slaughterhouses as a particularly egregious part of animal farming. Nobody likes to think about the animal being killed, or they like to pretend that they had a good life and just one bad day. Ended up not going with that because it sounded more like a fiction book, you know, The Last Slaughterhouse, for example. Mm-hmm. But we did a survey last year where 47% of U.S. adults say they support a ban on slaughterhouses. So if you want to focus on that aspect and talk about the killing killing of the animals, animal killing, animal slaughter, that can get a lot of people on board and rallying towards the cause.
Okay, that could be your next book.
Exactly. Or maybe a fiction book. I'm not a fiction writer. No.
All right. Okay. But there is value in fiction. And I want to talk later about the arts. So I just wanted to mention, while we're talking about history, I can't help but not say or mention Wryn Berry, who was a wonderful vegetarian historian. So whenever I think about his history related to this movement, I think about him because he was a wonderful writer and put out great information. And we lost him, unfortunately, a few years ago. We miss you, Wryn, and we love your work. Okay, so I highlighted a few things I wanted to talk about. Maybe not necessarily in the order of the book, because I was just randomly writing down after I read. But let's talk about the individual work versus the institution.
Mm. Exactly. So I know that you had Tobias Lienhardt on your radio show recently, and he makes the argument that we shouldn't be so focused on individual purity, on this go vegan message, on one-by-one conversion to a full vegan or a full plant-based diet or a vegan mindset or what have you. Instead, we should build a big tent, and we should bring people together with something like reducitarianism. My angle is similar. I'm not entirely in agreement with Tobias, but I do think that we've shot ourselves in the foot a bit as a movement by making helping farmed animals synonymous in the public eye with veganism. You know, when people think about even a farmed animal welfare campaign, you know, getting animals out of cages, which is often a stepping stone to caring about the broader issues, they will still think of it as, oh, that's a group of vegetarians or a group of vegans trying to do that. But my approach to this and the kind of view I've been converted to over my years of researching this is that we should be focused on bringing people together, working on policy change, working to change corporations, to have technology, to have government change, to change social norms, to build a community, to build a movement, all of these things that aren't just individual one-by-one diet change. And I try to make the case for that in the book. And in general, we have seen a shift towards that in the movement, I think. For example, with the technology, we see a lot of focus on, well, you know, there's an awareness of these issues. We just need to help people align their values, you know, as animal lovers like we are in the United States, with our behavior. And maybe we can do that by just giving people tools in a broad sense rather than by one diet change conversion. We've also seen a movement away from passing out a lot of leaflets as a big focus. I mean, that has its role. For example, if you want to give somebody something to do to volunteer on the weekends, you know, you could have them help out with a campaign or something online, you know, call their senator or something. And that's great. But often people want to be doing something active, going out on the streets. And leafleting can play a role there. Or, for example, with the pride parades, Mercy for Animals, an animal group, does a great job of passing out leaflets as they walk through the parade, and that's obviously a great tool. But I wouldn't put so much of a focus on just, hey, let's hand out enough leaflets, you know, hand out a billion leaflets and we'll convert 10 million people to vegetarianism or however you think the math adds up. Instead, we think we need a more holistic approach, and that's institutional change.
Very good. I thought of a couple of things while you were speaking. One is this purity issue, and I've been reading a bit, especially when it's related to people that are trying to lose weight, that if they're stuck on a rigid plan, there's this idea of perfectionism, and they feel really good while they're following all the rules and they're perfect. And then when they accidentally or whatever step outside of those boundaries and they fail, it feels really bad. And then trying to gain momentum to get back on the plan is very difficult. So this concept of being 100% and being pure and being perfect is maybe not the best one at all. We need to have a little flexibility and a little leeway so that we can move the continuum, when we can move the average of everyone to a better spot.
Yeah, I really like your comparison there. Identity in any sort of behavioral change is a powerful tool. You know, if you get somebody to identify as a vegan, if it becomes a part of their life, who they are as a person, that can be an incredible motivator for change. But it's always a matter of balance and what's the right allocation of resources towards that. You know, how much do we focus on purity? How much do we focus on taking bigger steps? And how much do we focus on smaller ones? And you just have to look at what the movement's done to date and say, okay, where have we allocated our resources and where do they need to move to reach the ideal allocation.
Okay, now I want to talk about individualism, the individual work versus institutional work. And I absolutely agree that today in 2018, we definitely need more policy and more businesses and government regulations and things that support every plant-based eating and ending animal farming and all of that. And there's a ton of research now. But decades ago, there wasn't. And that's where the importance of the individual really happened, even before the internet. Leafletting was all we had, really, because there wasn't all of this wonderful information that we had access to all over the place. So I think that laid the groundwork. It's maybe easier in hindsight to say, oh, maybe we should have gone this way or that way. But I think we're ripe now for more institution action.
Yeah, my argument is definitely for what we should do today. I have my own views on, you know, what would have been the optimal strategy historically, but it's very hard to speculate at that time. The case is a lot weaker for the reason you gave. I mean, if you just literally don't have enough people in a movement to create any policy change, like
it's
you don't have
happen.
Anyone who would buy the veggie burger at McDonald's, what's the sense in trying to get McDonald's to carry a veggie burger? But we can look at what historical movements have done, and not many of them have started by kind of building a base of individual abstainers from an industry. So they've attempted it, certainly. So in the movement against human slavery, for example, there were people personally abstaining from all slave-made goods. But that didn't really form a groundwork. So instead, what they went for was straight for that group change and changing what the laws were for slavery, for example. So I think you can bypass that a bit, but it's certainly a weaker argument because you do need this mass. But I mean, if you look at social media today, for example, and how many people are just raving about these new products that come out, they have the demand. The challenge there is incubating those companies and those products with plant-based friendly policies. So having college cafeterias that have, you know, a 20% mandate to reduce meat consumption, or Meatless Mondays or something. Or you have Whole Foods, which has just, you know, led the way in terms of being the first major retailer to get a lot of these new products out. Or just getting better products themselves, you know, having the business, having the technology, making it just a lot easier. I mean, not many people in any movement have been willing to make a change as big as going vegan, whether that's abstaining from slave-made goods, abstaining from, restaurants that had segregation in the 1960s, certain environmental approaches, for example. Not many people are electric cars or eco-friendly light bulbs. All of these things get a limited amount of the population. The sorts of people like you and me who are willing to change our behaviors to align with our morality and our values, and that's just always going to be a small minority of the population. And now it's the time at which we need to help people bridge that gap.
Yes. I just wanted to mention, I love that there are so many new products out. It's really very exciting. Someone like me, who's been vegetarian for about 45 years and vegan for 30, and to see this tremendous change, and it's all happening so fast now. I had a vegan festival here in New York City at Lincoln Center from 2001 to 2006, 5 years. It was outdoors on the campus. It was a spectacular event, but it was next to impossible to get exhibitors other than a few nonprofits. I did, but it was hard because the people just weren't there. There seemed to be a few more businesses in California that were happening then, not as many in New York. But the good thing about it was we were just putting it out there, and there was like 10,000 people that passed through that event. It was amazing because the location was great. Mm-hmm. But just dropping the seed of what veganism is, I think, was really great now. And I'm so thrilled to see all the businesses today. Mm-hmm. And let's talk about the investors support these businesses.
Yeah. If you think about an individual approach, so the group of investors that's been backing a lot of these companies is called the Vegan Mafia. And you have a lot of people who are in business or who are in journalism. So with the book launch, I've been interacting a lot with journalists. And a lot of the positive feedback I get, the people who will cover the book, are vegans or are vegetarians. And they supply a kind of mafia or a labor force in some sense, or a movement, a flank of the movement that has a lot of power in society and wants to help people align that. You know, for example, with welfare reforms. When McDonald's went cage-free, which was the big landmark, or the big, I can't think of the phrase right now. I want to say straw that broke the camel's back, but I can't say that here. got a cascade going of the whole egg industry to go cage free. That happened because of Carl Icahn, I believe was his name, a major investor who wanted to do something to help animals, identified as an animal lover, wasn't vegan. And that's what the Humane Society of the United States asked him to do was, hey, can you talk to McDonald's and get them to do this? And that just led to a cascade of changes, to more support for the farm animal movement in general, you know, not just farm animal welfare, but everything else too. And you can get a lot of momentum from that. And we have it right now. So I don't know of a company right now that's doing these innovative plant-based products or these new cultured meat products that hasn't been able to get sufficient early stage funding, because there are so many investors out there eager to back this.
Yes. Well, it's all about money.
Exactly. For better or worse.
We might touch on capitalism in a bit. Can we talk about the word natural? In your book, you talk about some of the reasons people will give for wanting to eat meat or not wanting to go vegan or plant-based. And one of them is that it's natural to eat meat. But we don't live in a natural society anymore, do we?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there are a number of ways to tackle the naturalness objection. And there have been some experiments to figure out which one's best, but it's not really clear. But a few angles. So one is that modern animal agriculture, I don't even want to say factory farming because it includes any way animals are farmed today, is extremely unnatural. You know, even just the breeds of animals, even if you're on a green pasture, you know, a big red barn, whatever, you're still using animals that are cows or chickens, you know, not red jungle fowl for chickens or aurochs for cows. They are unnatural species. They're artificial. Think of pugs or other dogs who are clearly not a being who would exist in the natural world. So in many ways today, you know, just our options are from a bunch of different unnatural products. We just don't have the option to eat. You know, you might have seen these photos. They'll show like what bananas looked like before domestication. Mm-hmm. They don't look appealing at all. They're green, huge seeds inside them. But there are other angles too. So, for example, you can just tackle whether naturalness in itself is a good thing. So philosophers even have made up a name called the appeal to nature, where people say, oh, because it's natural, it's good, when clearly that's not the case. You know, murder and rape and war and all these things were natural in a really important way. And yet they're obviously abhorrent and we don't want to do them today. Plenty of unnatural things are good, you know, modern sanitation or medicine or all of these things. So you can either, you know, explain why it's a choice between unnatural and unnatural, or you can just say naturalness doesn't matter, or you can talk about how these new products are natural in really important ways. So for example, a lot of these companies have a sustainability mandate and want their processes to be eco-friendly, because that's their whole brand, is they're doing something better than animal farming. So they're deciding to, you know, have more recycling their facilities or more, you know, power it with solar panels. Mm-hmm. I think is it Tofurky? One of these plant-based companies has like a solar-powered production facility.
Food for Life, maybe.
Yeah. Maybe multiple of them do too. Yeah. And they really are trying to be as natural as you can in the ways that matter, without obviously having to eat bananas with giant seeds in them.
I wouldn't mind bananas with giant seeds.
Yeah.
I like eating watermelon with seeds.
Exactly. And we're weird. Exactly.
Because I wouldn't mind it. It's fun to kind of spit out the seeds and just see them. Anyway, I don't like foods without seeds, because seeds are important to make more food.
Yeah, and I'm from the South, so, you know, sunflower seeds, you know, getting through the shell and having those and spitting them out on your porch in a rocking chair is a really fun experience.
How come I don't hear the accent from the South?
I grew up with a bit of one. So around half the people in my hometown had really strong accents. It's kind of drifted away as I lived in California and now in New York City. I considered reviving it for the book. It helps you reach out to people in red states in the U.S., for example. But it sounds really off-putting to a lot of other people. It makes you sound dumb
careful.
Republican or something. I mean, just talking about people's perceptions, not necessarily my own judgments. So I decided against it. I did decide to start wearing glasses. I didn't wear glasses for a long time. I'd wear contacts since I was a teenager. And I thought, look smarter.
Smarter, exactly. Wiser. Definitely.
Exactly.
Yeah, Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Hip. Yeah, glasses are good. Now, I opted today not to wear my glasses, and I'm wearing contact lenses. So how smart do I look?
Well, for the different contexts. So I was doing a filming for something, and there was a big glare on my glasses, and I had contacts in my backpack. So, I mean, being flexible is a really important part of any communication.
Absolutely. Okay. A few more topics. How much time do you have?
All the time you need.
Okay, I like it. Health versus environment versus the treatment of animals. These are three big topics, and many people decide how they're going to eat or change the way they eat because of one of these topics. I know for me, I was 15 when I realized who was on my plate, and it's always been the underlying factor for me has always been pain and suffering for non-human animals. Now, I've gotten more involved with health for lots of reasons. I'm a cancer survivor, and I help people move through that arena by helping them eat a healthier diet and boost their immune system, all that. But let's talk about each of those and what's most compelling to people.
Yeah, I have a lot of strong opinions, obviously, on vegan or animal advocacy strategy, but I don't have a very strong opinion on this one. It really depends so much on context, and there are clear pros and cons to each. So a lot of people will say health is the thing that everyone cares about. You know, you meet lots of people who don't care about animals, don't care about the environment, don't care about human rights or anything moral. Mm-hmm. They still care about the health of their food. They still want to be, you know, maybe eating salads or something. A lot of older people, you know, people who are suffering from heart disease are at high risk, a lot of older men. They think animal rights or even environmentalism is something for hippies. You know, like the places where I grew up, they just will listen more to a heart disease or a diabetes or some argument like that. And yet, with health, sometimes you see it as a trend, like we discussed at the beginning, or it's a passing thing. You know, a lot of people might say, yes, I will go vegan for, you know, 6 months to get my heart disease in check, and then I'll go back to whatever I was eating. Or maybe in some ways that are, you know, actually harmful. So, for example, people will abstain from red meat, but then eat even more chicken and even more fish products. And that can be bad for animal welfare because chickens and fish are smaller animals, so you have to consume more of them to create the same amount of calories, which could increase the total amount of animal suffering involved. With environmentalism, it's kind of a similar trade-off, maybe a middle ground between that and animal advocacy. With climate change, with a lot of these big environmental problems, I think you do muster some of the big moral motivation that comes with the animal message. You know, there is a movement against climate change right now, and I think it's only going to grow in the years ahead. You have companies that have sustainability mandates, and you can get them on board with Meatless Mondays or something like that through the environmental arguments. You know, if we look at activists in the movement, for example, what inspired them? It is a lot of animal arguments. There's something really compelling to people that makes them not just want to change for 6 months, but makes them want to become an activist. It makes them want to fight for this cause. I interviewed a lot of people who'd started these new companies in the book, and for them, definitely the majority of motivation is animal rights. Secondarily, it is those big picture environmental concerns like antibiotic resistance or climate change.
So there are so many reasons.
Yeah, exactly. Or, I mean, I even talked to people who are motivated at from a science perspective and just thought it was really inefficient and dumb that we were still getting meat, dairy, and eggs from animals when they're so wasteful. They're doing so many things other than producing just the calories and the nutrients we want and need.
You talk about scientists and entrepreneurs accepting this idea, but a few decades ago, they wouldn't have acknowledged that this is the right way to go. And a lot of scientists, a lot of business people didn't even have it on their radar or understood that it was a better thing to do. So we've really come a long way.
Yeah, it's actually tragic that in the neuroscience and the animal behavior community, that was one of the last groups in society to acknowledge animal sentience. People don't realize this, but it was really until the 1990s, maybe early 2000s, that they really started to accept the idea that animals matter, that they feel suffering like we do. They were kind of just, I think, my best guess, it's of course hard to speculate, is that they just had to go with the flow. You know, everyone around them was caring about animals. There were more discussions of especially the welfare of just dogs and cats. They had to acknowledge it in a sense. And it became, you know, the social norm change, the stigma change. And they just went along with the bandwagon of the rest of society.
There's so much that happened recently, which is really hard to believe. You frequently mention or compare the animal rights movement with other movements, civil rights movement, women's movement, the getting more rights for people of color, and there are a lot of similarities. But I'm just thinking, I interviewed a woman a few years ago. She had a book, Drink Like a Woman. It was a recipe book of alcoholic drinks. Mm. And what I didn't realize until I read it was every drink that she had in it was named after a great story by a woman that something that she had done in history. And one of the things I can't believe is that California was the last state, and I think it was in the 70s, to allow women to be bartenders.
Wow, I didn't know that. I do know that Switzerland was one of the last places on earth for women to get the right to vote.
Switzerland, which is such a cool country.
Exactly. They just have a really strong direct democracy process. So regions that are more conservative or have their status quo, their habits, what they're used to, are sometimes really reluctant to change. But you can get really exciting progress. So actually, there are two campaigns right now in the world to ban factory farming entirely. Mm. And one of them is a ballot initiative in Switzerland that takes advantage of that direct democracy ability.
Wow. Wow. So even though I frequently find reasons to be very frustrated and depressed and kind of annoyed with my species in general, if we reflect simply on recent history, it's a way to infuse yourself with inspiration because so much has happened with so many different issues.
Stephen Pinker, in terms of human rights issues, has written two really great books. Enlightenment Now is the more recent one, which argues that largely due to Enlightenment ideas, society has just made a ton of progress. And it doesn't reflect what we see in the news every day. You know, there are strong incentives for media outlets to be reporting on the disasters, the bad things, rather than all the good things that are happening. And then Better Angels of Our Nature, which argues for a decline in violence over the centuries. And I think both of those make solid cases. There are always, of course, things you can nitpick. But overall, in terms of humans, we're on a really good trend. And if the moral circle expands to animals, I think we're on a good trend there as well.
Good. I need more good news. Can we talk about capitalism a little bit and marketing? Mm. So there's a bigger picture here. And I think a lot of the problems we have in society are due to our culture and capitalism. Capitalism, the number one priority in capitalism is to profit. And we need to kind of infuse some other concepts into capitalism or change it a little bit, make it more cooperative, more compassionate, and kind of raise the importance of doing good in society. If we're going to survive. And a lot of the issues we have with animal rights and with civil rights, too, has to do with capitalism wanting to exploit people and to create products, businesses for a small group of people so that they can make as much as they can. And in the end, we exploit and we cause pain and suffering, and it's really a terrible thing. Mm. So you're talking about, in your book, working within this system. And I don't know if this system is even going to survive. But, I mean, I can see the value of creating businesses that work within a capitalistic system, getting investors that feel like they're going to have a return on their investment with products that can be profitable.
Yeah. So effective altruists, you know, this whole community of evidence-based do-gooders struggles a lot with what scale we work at. So first, you could rescue animals, you know, on an individual basis. You're very sure of the impact that you're having, but it's a relatively small number of beings who are affected, or it's a relatively small problem, you know, just one farm where the animals are abused and you're able to rescue them from that, all the way up to reinventing society in some big way, whether that's capitalism, whether you're trying to change the way voting works. You know, I have some friends who think that we really need preference voting instead of first past the post. Some other countries do. Some sort of fundamental change that will address human, animal, environmental, all sorts of issues in the world today. Where I've struck the balance, and it's of course a hard judgment to make, is that something the scale of animal farming. You know, it's a very large institution, so it's definitely not that individual animal rescue, but it's not reinventing society as a whole, and it's maybe more tractable than that sort of progress. Though I do think that the big thing animal advocates, big impact they have, is by expanding humanity's moral circle. And that's one of the reasons I harp on that so much. And the moral circle of society, you know, who we care about in our social norms, in our discussions, in our politics, in our businesses, and anywhere else in society, is relatively robust in the sense that if capitalism falls, or if there's disastrous climate change, or what have you, whether you think these things are good or bad or whatever, I think the moral circle will probably persist in the sense that if we have led people to care more about these animals, to see animals less as meat, dairy, and eggs, and more as sentient beings in their own right, that will persist, and that will be progress, and it's robust in that sense, and it's a significant impact.
I have to admit, personally, how I feel personally, I don't like the idea of meat analogs and clean meats. Mm. It's a personal thing. I understand in our culture, it's probably the only way to go. But what's frustrating for me, I talk a lot about healthy eating. I'm very passionate about whole food, plant diets, and I help a lot of people move that way. And it seems to me that we're kind of going the long way around the world to get to the best place for humanity. And that's frustrating.
It's frustrating. I feel frustrated. I mean, yeah, so at the end of the book, I talk a lot about the distant future and where do I want that moral circle to go in the long run and kind of what's my utopia in at least that sense. And I do at times want to just, I don't know, get on a big media network. So I was just on Young Turks and talk to them about why we should care about insects and robots who can feel and like what we need to do when we colonize the universe to build a better society. But unfortunately, I wasn't able to do that. I had to focus more on getting him to understand, the host, Jink, that animals were sentient and that they matter. You know, that was the step he needed to take. And I had to meet him where he was and pull him in a different direction. So he brought up insects briefly, for example. But it's a slow process and it's frustrating, and I think that's just the way things are.
It's just the way things are. Then the other piece of that is advertising and marketing. And I'm going to apologize to all the humans out there, but we have this characteristic, and it's an odd thing because we have an expression that has to do with animals. We're like sheep, and I don't even know if sheep are really like this, but we can be very moldable. And we can be made, I think, relatively easily to go in a certain direction. Mm-hmm. And history shows that over and over, most of the time not in a very nice way. And we marketing has taken advantage of that. And we have all these wonderful scientists out there that are creating all these artificial flavors and flavorings to get people to want to eat more of the food that's in that these artificial flavorings are in, whether the food is healthy or not. It's just something that promotes profit. And with advertising, the right advertising and marketing, people can buy anything or want to eat anything. And because broccoli and organic apples don't have the biggest profit margin, we can't convince people that that's the best way to go.
Yeah, it's tough. Some people will say that as humanity has more and more resources, is less in need, has less of a limited budget, you know, in a sense, we will be able to flex our moral muscles and have a more compassionate society because we'll have the resources to spare. You know, once people are able to get their individual needs met, once society as a whole is able to, you know, everyone can purchase those healthy foods and we can live in the nice houses and things like this. You know, think of if we, I don't know, make a fusion or something and then energy becomes so much cheaper and we can just build whatever we want, then what will be stopping us from, you know, having a more compassionate society? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you think of why factory farming exists or why, indeed, almost any form of animal exploitation exists, it's almost entirely because they do something we want. You know, they produce meat, dairy,
and eggs. We've been made to believe we want that.
So currently we want, and we might be able to transcend that in the sense that if we're able to get protein, if we're able to convince people either to eat whole plant-based foods or get cultured meat in front of people, I think, you know, people are lazy in that sense, and they will go with the flow, and that will be a force kind of for moral progress, even though, like you said, many times throughout history, it's been a force for moral backsliding and for negativity.
Good. What else would you like to highlight in this wonderful book that you've written?
Oh, I'm mostly excited for the book to change the conversation around these issues. So we went straight to the heart of things in the sense that focusing on institutions, on working collectively, on building a big tent for the movement and on having a movement that wants to end animal farming or to build a vegan world, if you really want to use the term vegan, rather than just to create more vegans and to have one-by-one diet change, which I would say is the majority of focus in the movement today. And then secondly, to have a movement that's thinking not just just about farmed animals or not any specific group, but is instead encouraging an expansion of humanity's moral circle in general. Because really, again, it goes back to those effective altruism arguments. I do want to do the most good for all sentient beings. And that includes those who we might not even be thinking about today. You know, you could have factory farming exist in some way we haven't even thought of. You know, maybe some sort of extremely large-scale scientific experimentation. Or maybe we're able to, yeah, create robots who can think and feel like biological animals, and we abuse them in similar ways, you know, 1,000 years from now. And I want us to have the moral power to not do that as a society and to build a better world than what we have today.
Isn't that beautiful? I'm going to kind of like hold that now. Take a breath, everybody. Oh, I haven't talked about breathing lately in the show, but it's what I do for a living.
Mm, yeah.
And it's very important. That was my way of underlining all of that. Thank you. So let me just lighten it up. You're in Brooklyn. And where's your favorite place for eating?
In Brooklyn or in
anywhere in the world?
Delice and Saracen. It's a French restaurant. Oh, mm-hmm. So they've got steak tartare, foie gras, escargot, all these things. They're a bit expensive. So if I want somewhere cheaper, I'll usually just stay at home and have rice and beans or something like that. I like to cook for friends. So we had a brunch where we actually had you can spend on like one kind of fancy vegan food like tofurkey or something and then have cheap food all around it and actually makes for a really good meal. So we made a breakfast scramble that was tofurkey sausage. And then just had like apples and grains and herbs and other things.
Yeah. Nice. I have to say, I haven't been to Delice et Saracen, and it's on my list, but I just haven't managed to make it there. And I love French food. I lived in France for 4 years as a vegan in the early 90s. Yes, it's possible. It was possible. And I'm big on making buckwheat crepes.
Yeah, yeah. I use it to wow people. So if I have a friend who's not vegan, not even involved in these issues, and I just want to, you know, show them something incredible, it's to have steak tartare that's vegan or foie gras. As you know, foie gras has gotten obviously such a negative reputation for good reason. And if you can show people that we can get it without using animals, the whole house falls down.
That's good. My last question for you is. At the end of the book, you proposed. How did that go?
It went really well. So I ended up showing her that this summer. It's in the acknowledgments in the book, partly because the book was getting out to a lot of people at that stage. So people I didn't know were reading it were starting to read it, at which point it could have very easily gotten back to my now fiance. So we went
She accepted.
She did accept. Yeah, yeah. Sorry, I should have said that first. Ease the tension. So we were on a rowboat in Central Park, and I showed it to her, and my friend was filming from behind a tree, and she read it out loud and started crying as she was reading it, and then I got on one knee and proposed.
Let's do that all together. That's really very, very sweet. Whew. Well, I want to thank you for joining me. You're welcome to stay for the rest of the hour or if you need to move on, but I'm going to talk about a few other things that I want to bring up.
Well, I should grab dinner with somebody.
Oh, grab dinner.
Yeah,
great.
Not at Delice, at Ramen Hood. Have you been there?
I haven't. Do they have good vegan options?
Yeah, it's a vegan ramen place. So it's not very
Ramen Hood.
It's they've got lots of mushrooms. That's kind of their protein in there. So if you like kind of more whole, I mean, they're noodles, but
right.
whole plant-based.
Do they have gluten-free noodles too? Who knows?
Yes, they
Check
do.
Check back.
They do.
Let me know.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, thanks so much for having me,
Thank
Karen.
Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Okay. Bye. Okay, everybody, that's J.C. Reese, the author of The End of Animal Farming, How Scientists, Entrepreneurs, and Activists Are Building an Animal-Free Food System. Awesome. I really enjoyed that conversation. Okay, so moving on, I wanted to bring up a few things. Bye, J.C.
Thank you.
You may know, last week I missed this show, and that's because I was in California. I spent a lot of time in the Bay Area in San Jose, California, and I was giving a concert for a nonprofit organization, a theater company called Playful People Productions. It's a group my partner Gary and I work a lot with, and one of the things I love about this organization is in their mission, it's about being kind. And that kind of fits in with my mission, being kind to all living things on this planet. And it was absolutely a wonderful thing for me to be the headliner of the fundraiser and give a concert. And I kind of likened it to a marathon or a running event or something really physical, because singing can be very physical. And for me, it was like 2 hours of being on top and singing. And the only way I think I could do it, or anyone can really, is making sure they eat nutritious food. And so all week I was very vigilant. I'm always vigilant, but really putting the energy to make sure that I was eating well so that I would be ready. Eating well, hydrating, doing all of those things. And I came up with a tea blend. I've been talking about this recently, herbal tea. I don't want to rely on caffeine. And I've been making a wonderful blend. Right now I'm drinking a combination of savory, marjoram, basil, aniseed or fennel, depends on what I have in the house, and a little turmeric and black pepper. Of course, black pepper helps make turmeric more absorbable, and I like the way it gives the tea a kick, like chai tea has pepper in it, gives it a kick. And that's what I'm brewing lately. You might try it yourself, but you have to have all of those herbs and spices in the house. Now, if you don't have savory and marjoram, you can use some of those other herbs like parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme, or oregano. Okay, you got that? Great. I also wanted to mention the Vegetarian House in San Jose. I've talked about this restaurant a lot, and the beginning of this year, I interviewed the manager, Sonny Mueller. Well, we hadn't gone to Vegetarian House the entire time we were in San Jose, and so it was the day before we were leaving. I said, we have to go there because it's our home away from home. And if you haven't been there and if you get to the Bay Area, please go there and tell them I sent you. The staff is just wonderful, and they were all so welcoming when we walked in, and we had a wonderful meal. And then at the end, Sonny came around and he just kept giving us things to take along with us, all kinds of wonderful vegan chocolates. So that was really fun. And I have a lot of gratitude for them. So I just want to promote them as much as I can. Another thing I wanted to bring up, I know a lot of people, especially women, struggle when they have a bone scan and they discover that they have osteopenia or osteoporosis. It can be a scary thing. Number one, I don't put a lot of weight into those scans in terms of the likelihood of your bones becoming brittle and you withering away. There is a great likelihood as we age of falling. And the best way to get around that is to exercise and do exercises that help your balance and strengthen your legs and your hips and your arms. I find that sometimes when I fall, I tend to fall into a yoga pose because I do a lot of yoga and my brain is like wired to do that. So it really helps. But I want to mention a colleague and a great activist, Zoe Weil. She's promoted humane education, and she put out a post on Facebook recently, and I just wanted to share it because it's such an inspiration. She was diagnosed with osteopenia and I think osteoporosis, and she decided to do something about it, and she really upped her exercise and joined a CrossFit organization, I think that's what it was called, worked with a trainer, and started lots of impact weight exercises, weightlifting. And she reported about a year ago she had significant improvement. And then 2 years into it, really tremendous improvement where she's totally fit and her bones are perfectly healthy and decades younger than her age. So that's a lot of inspiration. So if you're struggling and you found out that your bones are weakening, there are a lot of things you can do. You can eat healthy, nutritious food that helps build bones and muscle, because we can't have strong bones unless we have strong muscles. They work in harmony together. And the exercise will help build the muscles, and the nutrition will be there when your bones are calling for the nutrients it needs to build itself. It's a beautiful thing. And of course, it's a whole food plant diet that provides the nutrients we need. Lots of dark leafy green vegetables that will give the bones what they need to build when they want to build. I thought that was really an inspirational story. And it's kind of inspiring me. I do a certain amount of exercise, but now I'm ready to up my exercise up a little bit more and get more impact exercises in there, more weight training in there to build my muscle and my bone, because I'm not getting any younger and neither are you. I also wanted to mention a company. Now, I'm not getting any compensation for this. It's just a product or a few products that I recently purchased and I've used, and I want to tell you about it because I'm very impressed. For those of you out there who use makeup like mascara and eyeliner, I just started using products by Thrive Cosmetics. Have you heard about them? Thrive Cosmetics. Yes, they are 100% vegan, so I'm happy to promote them. And listen to their name, Thrive Cosmetics. They do a lot of wonderful donating to causes that we believe in. In fact, they had a mission to donate, I believe, to, I'm not going to get this right, but I think they were giving to women in particular who had specific needs. And then when the forest fires in California came about, they modified their mission a little so that they were able to donate last month to Northern California to those that had been affected by the horrible fires. And that's a lovely thing. I believe they gave over $250,000 to that cause. So that's a great company that I am happy to talk about and promote. Are there products that you really like that are vegan, that are healthy, or just make you feel good? Let me know about them, because I don't know everything. And I like when we share. And do you know where to write to me so that you can let me know? info@realmeals.org, info@realmeals.org. I am also still accepting comments. I'm also still soliciting comments. I want to hear from you, my listeners, about what you think about this program. I mentioned it briefly before, but I just wanted to underline it. And that is this idea about perfectionism and identifying with a group that has rules to follow or ideals to follow. It was really apparent to me about, how long ago was it? About 14 years ago, I followed an all raw diet. And it was challenging, but it was very clear what I could and could not do. I had decided to eat foods that hadn't been cooked. And I started going to conferences and going to lectures, and I really felt that holier-than-thou thing amongst the community about people who were only eating raw. You can kind of identify with the tribe, the particular tribe, and then feel a certain amount of superiority to being part of it. And then at the same time, if you're finding that you cannot meet the expectations of that particular group or that particular label that requires certain things to wear that label, it can be debilitating, devastating. And I'm not all raw anymore, but I am vegan. And for me, when it comes to veganism, it's not a label that I wear as something to feel superior about. And moving to an all-plant diet was not something that I personally found difficult. I know people struggle with it, but for me, I don't see certain things as food. I don't see certain beings as food, like animals or their products. And this happened pretty quickly in my transition. Now, I was vegetarian for a while, but as soon as I decided to be vegan, it was just boom, like that, because I had a lot of understanding and a lot of education, and it was simple. But I still know that many people struggle. So I encourage you, if you want to do this vegan thing for ethical reasons, that's the best thing to focus on, the who that is being exploited, the who that is the one that we're using for our own personal pleasures. Yes. So that's my discussion about perfectionism versus veganism. So we just have a minute left. And I guess I'm pretty much finished with all my notes and what I wanted to talk about. So I want to invite you to responsibleeatingandliving.com. That's where I live. That's the nonprofit. The end of the year is coming around, and I hope when you're thinking about organizations to support, you would consider Responsible Eating and Living. Go to responsibleeatingandliving.com. We have lots of wonderful recipes, and 7 of our recipes have just been accepted in a new cookbook that are coming out in 2019, the Eat for the Planet cookbook. Now, I had Neil Zacharias on the program a few months ago, and Gary and I are happy to be the top contributor to that cookbook. So look for that coming out next year. All right, everybody, I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Have a very delicious week.